Okay, let's resume. The time is 10:40 a.m. and the next agenda item is 2009-2010 number 45, healthcare choice. This is before the board on a motion for rehearing. Mr. Gruskin, on behalf of the movements for the motion for rehearing, if you'd like to come forward and identify yourself for the record and give us your arguments. We do have the benefit of your written arguments as well, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Gruskin, and I represent Dr. Mark Ernest and the other movements on this motion. I am happy to address the specific issues. I have a number of documents to provide to the board and in support of the arguments that we're making, and would be happy to either break it up in terms of the jurisdictional arguments and the accuracy arguments, or do it all at once, whatever the board's pleasure is.
I don't have any preference about it. If we want to go through them one by one, if you're prepared to do that, that's what we'll do, and then I guess if we break that up, then I guess a question would be, then do we discuss each one and provide the proponents an opportunity to respond, or whether we just work through yours one at a time and then go to proponents. So do you have a preference?
They're actually interlinked in a lot of different ways, so maybe just going through them all would be a more efficient way.
Okay.
So all right, let's do that.
Let's do that.
Before I get underway, let me, if I could, hand the board copies of the documents that I'm about to reference. Let me also hand them to the... And I'd like to provide copies for the record, in addition, so that in the off chance we end up at the Supreme Court, that there's a set of documents that have been certified by the board.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The initial argument made in the motion is that this initiative really addresses multiple subjects. We have listed in the motion the various subjects that we believe are addressed, and I know that you've read the motion. I'm not inclined necessarily to address each particular element. Let me say, though, that the stated single subject, the right of all persons to health care choice, is one of those phrases that the court, in my view, routinely addresses and criticizes as something that is simply too general a category to qualify as a single subject, much like the issue of water in the water case, or the judicial branch in the various judiciary cases, or government spending in the Tabor-related cases. The right of healthcare choice simply is too broad to be a single subject. It means different things to different people. Is the right to healthcare choice the right to A, choose your own physician, B, choose your own course of treatment, C, determine the contours and the parameters of a doctor-patient relationship, D, determine the payment system that will operate to account for your health care? Which among those, or all of those, is comprised by the phrase right to health care choice? We think that this measure clearly deals with a variety of different types of healthcare-related issues, not the least of which are the interrelationship of an individual with his or her insurance company, or the requirement, frankly, that one have insurance, and the relationship between a person and his or her healthcare provider, and the, under this measure, the right to address that on an individual basis. Now, we have a video that we'd like to play. It's indicated under exhibit number one. It's very brief. It is the second one that Ms. Gomez can show. And we're ready. Go ahead.
It is time, I believe, Colorado stand up and defend herself against Obamacare. And it is our goal to make Colorado a sanctuary state for good health care. What we're trying to do with this initiative is to blunt what is to be a likely attack on our state's rights from D.C. This initiative, this law, does three very basic but important things. In this addition to the Bill of Rights in Colorado, it guarantees that all persons shall have a right of health care choice. What that means is that the state nor the federal government can mandate someone to purchase an insurance product or to participate in any public or private health care plan or benefit. Furthermore, it protects a private ability to buy health care services. We want to have a protection to make sure that Colorado, unlike places, provinces in Canada, do not grow some time where you cannot purchase private health care products and services. And thirdly, we want to open up the market for Coloradans. So this initiative also opens up cross-state purchasing of insurance products from around the country.
This is a candid statement by the proponents as to what the measure did. Now, as we all know, that third element is no longer in this measure. But it does retain two elements which are identified as distinct and not necessarily related by any sort of common theme, other than the fact that they have something to do with healthcare, which is simply too general a relationship to allow this board to set a title for this measure. And oftentimes the statements of the proponents are taken into consideration both by the board and by the courts, and we think it's appropriate here to acknowledge that, albeit in our motion we split out state and federal provisions as they are triggered by this measure, that there is an overarching desire to create, in the words of the video, Colorado is a sanctuary state. In other words, take Colorado out of the federal system. The second and third elements are specific, and they are different. And I don't know that I need to restate what's in the motion or what was said on the video. And we also believe that the expansion of what a lawful health care service is in, under this measure is a separate subject. So we would ask you to determine that this is a multi-topic measure and that it cannot be set for title in light of the acknowledgement on the part of the proponents that there are independent and not necessarily connected, fundamentally connected elements of the measure. Second, the second jurisdictional issue is the argument that I made, I believe, a couple title board meetings ago, and I'm not going to belabor it, but it's the fact that that very first purpose, taking the state out of federal laws, is not something that that the initiative process is geared to do or that this board can set a title for. I'm not going to belabor it because you've considered that issue and rejected it, and absent some epiphany in the last several weeks, I imagine that will be your decision here too. Third, I think that paying close attention to what this measure does is important because the title, as we point out, is misleading. This doesn't limit legislative authority. This doesn't constrain the General Assembly or any department from enacting particular types of rules. What this measure does is says that no statute, regulation, resolution, or policy adopted or enforced by the state of Colorado, its departments and agencies, independently or at the instance of the United States, shall. So there's nothing here that prohibits the state of Colorado or any of its agencies from establishing these policies. It's simply a question of how they are applied, how they are administered, how they are implemented. And administration of an existing or potential policy, even, but we would certainly argue that this doesn't even address limitations on the adoption of new policies. The administration of any policy is outside of the initiative process. The courts have been very clear in Colorado that the legislative authority ends when the issue of implementing an already existing legislative policy begins. And to the extent that that is exactly what this measure attempts to do, I would suggest that this board has no jurisdiction to set a title, because this measure does not attempt to limit the adoption of policies that would have the effects that are complained of in the measure. Fourth, the board lacks jurisdiction where legislative resolutions are at issue. The measure, by its express terminology, states that it applies to, and I quote, statutes, regulations, resolutions, or policies. The Colorado Supreme Court has addressed this issue in the referendum context to say that Article 5, Section 1 doesn't apply to resolutions. It quoted the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon, which had addressed a similar issue, which had also said that their initiative and referendum statutes and rights didn't apply to resolutions. And we think that by including resolutions here, that was a choice the proponents made, but it takes them outside of the initiative process. And much like a single subject issue, you can have an initiative that is 95% one subject, but if 5% of language is committed to a second subject, it violates that requirement, and we think it violates that requirement here. Let me move into the accuracy and misleading issues that are denominated in our motion. First, we think that there are several elements that require clarification for the in the title. Number one, directly or indirectly, is a phrase that was added after this was heard by legislative council. We think that expands the nature of who is affected. We think that it should be clear that it's any public or health or private health insurance plan, to make it clear just how expansive this is. The term or benefit for some reason was left out of the litany in the measure. And finally, the requirement that lawful healthcare services be addressed, that it's by law, and we just think that that the exception relating to emergency medical treatment required is simply there in the measure, and it's not clear whether it's required by good medical practice or required by law or required by insurance policy provisions or anything else. We think that it ought to be clear in the title that the requirement that will trigger the exception is one of what is in the statutes, presumably regulations or policies of some competent jurisdiction. Second, as I suggested earlier, this title is inaccurate. It reads that the measure after the single subject statement prohibiting the state independently or at the instance of the United States from adopting or enforcing any statute. Well, there is no prohibition on adoption or enforcement. It's just that the measure can't be given the effect in the context of an adoption or an enforcement. So it is a misnomer to say that there is a limitation imposed upon the state. I have no idea how this is ultimately going to be lived out. But obviously it had to be worded this way because it was going after a federal law. That it was worded this way ought to be accurately reflected in the title, and it is not. And so we think that that is an element that needs to be fixed. Third, the right of all persons to health care choice is misleading for two reasons, one of which I've already mentioned, one of which is specifically denominated here. First of all, the right of all persons to health care choice is unknowable in terms of what that means. I've already suggested to you that it could mean several different things. But secondly, it does not preserve all choices. It preserves certain choices. Certain choices as to payment systems for healthcare. And that's all it preserves. And it doesn't even preserve all of the choices available in payment systems. It simply preserves two independent arrangements. One between the government and an individual as to a mandate for health insurance purchase, and the second between a healthcare provider and a patient. It is misleading to use that phrase, and we think that that it ought to be struck in favor of something that is more accurate. Frankly, the bulk of what I'd like to present to you in the next, ought to take about 3 minutes, relates to the fourth argument that we've made. The right of all persons to health care choice is a political slogan, plain and simple. And it's a very effective political slogan. As you know, the Colorado Supreme Court, in terms of deciding whether or not something is a catchphrase, holds that phrase up to the context of current political engagement, current political debate. And I would like to establish for you right now that the right to health care choice is a slogan infused with political weight, meaningless here, but infused with political weight. And I say it's meaningless because this isn't really a measure that addresses all of the possible healthcare choices that could be made. Let's go to the PDFs. Number two, in your packet, what I'd like you to go to is the third one. Thanks. In the recent debate over healthcare reform, many groups grew up in terms of both proponents and opponents to this measure. One of the key opposing groups used healthcare choice as the center of its name and the center of its pitch, Consumers for Healthcare Choices. I might note that all of these exhibits are taken off the internet, and the internet addresses have been provided on the cover page of the packet that is before you. Let's go back to the second PDF. Let's go back to PDFs. That phrase, go to the next to last one. Thanks. That phrase shown in Exhibit 3 is something that appears in this group's op-ed pieces, for instance. I mean, it's not just what they pay for. It's what they put out to have help define the contours of political debate. This is an editorial by Mr. Ferrara that he entitled and placed on their website and then got placed in various newspapers. Proposed overhaul would kill health care choice. Now, this isn't an issue that's lost on at least one of the proponents. And in the local press, this phrase has also been trotted out. Go back to the menu and the second one on your list. Linda Gorman, who is a proponent of this measure, recently had printed in the Aurora Sentinel an article that is entitled by the paper, and then you can see in the first line by the authors, "Why We're Crazy About Healthcare Choice." Healthcare choice has political weight, and it has political meaning. Oftentimes, when you are asked to strike a particular phrase because of its political meaning, people say, "I can tell you, you'll hear that in TV ads." But what if I could show you that this is exactly the kind of phrase that gets used in this debate in TV ads? Let's go back, Jesse, to the videos. The last one. This is an ad placed by a group called Conservatives for Patients' Rights. More than $1 million.
It's an old joke. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help.
Can you stop that?
Reply to health.
Printed news reports established that each of the ads I'm about to show you had well over $1 million behind them in terms of broadcast. This isn't some isolated, do-it-yourself, do-it-at-home kind of undertaking. Go ahead, let's play this.
Care, it could mean taking away your choice.
Some want the government to offer a health insurance plan, but experts say a government plan could result in 119 million Americans coming off their existing coverage. They'd end up on a government-run plan. leaving no choice. And that's no joke.
Tell Congress, any plan that takes away your choice in health care is not an option.
Okay. Twice you hear the dialogue, the monologue about choice. You see it stamped up on the screen, and I've included that particular shot under exhibit number 5, as I've also included the transcript of that ad with the audio and visual. It is clear that choice is a significant factor there, but nothing like the ad you're about to see, if you click on the first one, which is indicated by exhibit 6 in your packet.
There are hundreds of choices in healthcare plans today, but imagine this is the massive government-run insurance plan some in Congress want. This government-run plan could crush all your other choices, driving them out of existence, resulting in 119 million off their current insurance coverage, leaving no choices in health insurance, and government in control of your healthcare.
It's not too late. Protect your healthcare choices. Tell Congress to say no to a government-run plan.
All right, now, maybe what we're talking about is simple serendipity. The proponents decided to have a measure, they called it healthcare choice, and this particular political debate was defined by the issue of healthcare choice, which I would say for the record, but I think you could take notice of. Fact is that this campaign was very effective because there was no public option as a result of public outcry after this particular campaign set in. So, are we talking about serendipity here? I don't think so. But before we get to that issue, let me just refer you to Exhibit 7, the Neutral Annenberg Public Policy Center, associated with the University of Pennsylvania, analyzes ads, political ads. And it took a look at the bulldozer ad you just saw, the one that crushes the words healthcare choices. And its assessment of that ad is that it is, quote, more healthcare scare. And it specifically points out the ad also falsely cites the New York Times as the source of the statement that what's being proposed would leave no consumer choices and government in control of your health care. Times didn't say that at all. The newspaper was just quoting claims made by insurance companies and members of Congress. The point is, that is a very effective political tool. And it's not just me saying that. And it's not just your eyes and ears. Let me suggest to you, though, that it isn't just serendipity here. That this campaign that you saw was determined by political pros much smarter than me. You might recall in early May of last year, and it's reflected in Exhibit 8, there was a memo that was widely discussed in the media by a well-regarded political pollster in Washington, Frank Luntz. And what Luntz did is he took a look at all of the phrases that can be used in healthcare debate. And he advised congressional Republicans which ones to use and which ones not to use. And specifically, Exhibit 8 shows you where this was discussed publicly. Exhibit 9 shows you where this particular poll was made available on the internet. It was a conversation, or it was an article about Frank Luntz summing up his approach and an interview that he had with the New York Times, where when asked about why he used the words he used or why he prioritized them, he said, look, I'm not a policy person, I'm a language person. Well, he used language for a reason, and I'll suggest to you that it was to affect the political debate. Exhibit number 10, which appears to have been, at least in some of the copies, it's like it's Hebrew, it reads from right to left. It starts at the back. You may have page 1 at the very end. You may have it at the beginning of Exhibit 10. This document is what you can access if you use the link in Exhibit number 9, where it talks about pen to healthcare messaging memo. This is that memo. This is Luntz's actual memo. It's entitled The Language of Healthcare 2009, The 10 Rules for Stopping the Washington Takeover of Healthcare. And if you go to page 28, throughout the memo, he analyzes various issues of what to say and what not to say. He has boxes that talk about words that work. Sprinkled through there is the word choice. But I want you to focus on his last several pages, what he calls, starting on page 26, the healthcare glossary, words that work and what not to say. On page 28, he has never say and instead say. And if you look at the second level of boxes, he asks the question of various people in his polling technique, which healthcare policy do you want the most? The first answer is inferentially about choice. The second one is clearly about choice. I should have the right to choose the healthcare that's right for me. Then he asks people, which healthcare statement do you agree with? The answer that hold the best, the freedom to choose the doctor, hospital, and plan that's best for me. And then he said, which healthcare right matters most? Answer, the right to choose the doctor, hospital, and policy that fits your individual needs. Now, again, what use was this put to, this document? Well, Mr. Luntz answers that question on page 3. And I'll read it to you so it's in the record. Quote, this document is based on polling results and instant response dial sessions conducted in April 2009. It captures not just what Americans want to see, but exactly what they want to hear. The words that work boxes that follow are already being used by a few congressional and senatorial Republicans. From today forward, they should be used by everyone. But don't expect to reach everyone. More than one quarter of the population will back significant governmental involvement in healthcare, and a third support universal care. This is what's important. The primary message of this document is to focus on the persuadables and generate support among wayward Republicans and conservatives. Here's how. So this document is all about creating political leverage. That's what Mr. Luntz says. You saw the ads that emanate from this piece, as we point out in our exhibits. Those are ads that appeared a month after this document was publicly available. And they highlight the hysteria over the use of the words right to healthcare choice. We think that this is a measure that, if it is one subject, and we doubt it is, but even if it is, it's certainly, that subject isn't the right of all persons to healthcare choice. And we suggest that that phrase needs to be struck in its entirety from the title. It simply is, as you saw on the screen, an explosive phrase. We have one other argument as to the accuracy of the title. It's an argument that I believe we made last time. We believe that there is a new and controversial legal standard for defining lawful healthcare choices to include not just things that are lawful here, but things that are prohibited here. I think that it would be a mistake to have a title that doesn't address that change in a standard that people pretty much have come to rely on. I thank you for a significant amount of time you've allotted to me, and if you've got questions, I'm happy.
Any questions for Mr. Gruskin? One thing that I want to ask about sort of goes to, I think, the heart of how to read the introductory portion of subsection 1, and I think it relates to maybe more than one issue that you've raised, such as whether this is legislative or administrative in character and so forth. But I was having some difficulty understanding the way you were reading that. I mean, the way I see it, I mean, I think you were saying it doesn't, for example, you were saying it doesn't prohibit the legislature from doing anything. And I'm having trouble following that. It basically says no statute shall, A or B, no statute shall. Now, it also has regulation, resolution, et cetera. But focusing on the word statute for a moment, there's some additional language that says that it's particular statutes. It's statutes that are adopted or enforced by the state of Colorado. And it's statutes that are done so either independently by the legislature, for example, or perhaps because the federal government wants the legislature to do that. But basically, it's saying no statute shall. And it seemed like that is a prohibition on the adoption of statutes and the enforcement of statutes. That's how I take that. And in that respect, it seems like the title is accurate. But But I hear you reading it differently. So
I do read it differently, and I apologize for not being clear my first time through. I don't think that you can skip over the word adopted. So it's not just no statute shall. It's no statute adopted by the General Assembly. Shall. So that means the legislature can adopt certain statutes. They may not be administered such that they have this impact, but there's no limitation. This measure does not say the General Assembly shall not adopt a statute that, you know, 1 and 2 under the measure. And I think that's different. There's nothing to keep the General Assembly under this measure from adopting a statute that requires someone to participate in a public or health, private health insurance program. It doesn't stop them from doing it. Now, it may not be able to be administered by the Department of Public Health or whoever administers those statutes in that manner, but it doesn't keep the legislature from enacting that kind of a statute. It may not be enforceable, I think is part of the argument that's being made. And if I grant you that argument, then we're at one on the issue that this is about how the statute is administered, how it's implemented, which means it's not a subject for the use of the initiative power.
I'm still having trouble following it. I mean, I'm granted there's different ways to word this, but I guess one way I'm looking at it is, you know, this is something for the Bill of Rights. You know, and the first statement is granting the right to health care choice. So, by analogy, if we were looking at another, say, the right of due process, you know, a constitutional provision that says all persons shall have the right to due process, and then if the measure went on, if the constitutional right went on to say, you know, no statute adopted or enforced by the General Assembly shall deprive people of blah, 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 and it talks about due process. Well, of course the General Assembly can adopt statutes that violate that, but they, as you say, they'd be unenforceable. So it operates as a prohibition. That's what I sort of see here as well. There's a right granted, and no statute shall be adopted or enforced that violates certain principles.
Well, let me just back up a little bit, because once the people act and then the legislature acts, presumably the court's going to try and give effect to both enactments, right? This amendment and whatever the legislature does. And only if there is an irreconcilable conflict will the statute in part potentially be struck. I suppose it could all be struck. But the legislature, I mean, it's a common rule of construction that the courts will give effect to what the legislature's done. So there's nothing to keep the legislature from adopting a statute to see how far the edge of that language goes. There is nothing on an institutional or structural basis where if a bill got proposed to do this, it could not be enacted, that the legislature could not take the next step of putting it into play from a policy point of view. And if someone wants to contest its applicability or its enforceability or its administration, they could do so. But I just think this isn't a measure that actually prohibits that adoption. And you know what? You and I may just be taking a look at a very fine legal point from very different points of view. I accept that.
Mr. Domenico?
Yeah, I mean, I think the limitation on the initiative process is not, I don't think, as sophisticated as the argument you're making. I mean, the point of the initiative limitation is only things that the legislature essentially could do are proper for initiative. I think we agree with that. That only things that they can't tell the governor how to run his office or those sorts of purely executive things through the initiative.
I think the legislature passes all sorts of administrative statutes, but you know, naming a building, for instance, that's not something that you could undo by right of initiative and rename it to something else.
Well, but I think the legislature could pass a law that prohibits the executive branch from enforcing certain types of policy decisions or something like that. Say there was a dispute between the governor and the legislature, and the legislature, I think, could say, we think you're misinterpreting these laws, or we don't want you to enforce laws this way. I think outside of purely administrative stuff, the legislature could do that. That's to the extent that this is similar to that, I think that that it's still within the right of initiative. I'm not sure I understand why. I mean, I'm with Mr. Hobbs. Even if I think I disagree on how this is read, first of all. It's written in this tense or mood, I think, because it's meant to be broadly interpreted to cover both future enactments by the legislature or make sure that past laws aren't enforced in a certain way. That's entirely proper for initiative, in my view. And I think that's all it does. I don't think it seeks to say the legislature can do whatever it wants, but we're just going to say that the executive branch can't do certain things. This seems right in line with both what legislatures do and with what's done in initiatives all the time.
Pardon?
So, Mr. Gruskin, again, just focusing... Are you done?
I'm done, yeah.
I'm sorry. And I don't know, Mr. Gruskin, I didn't mean to cut you off. If you want to
respond. The truth is, this is an issue that is frankly, I think Mr. Kneiser will admit, this isn't one that the court's really looked at. So we don't have a lot of instruction as to what it's, you know, how it would address this issue. And so it will probably be given the at least 2-0 or potentially 3-0 views expressed by the board so far. It'll be an interesting issue for the court to address, because in the local context, it has been much more clear than in the statewide context about the limitation on the right of initiative, not going so far as to allow the administration. But I hear your point. It's a valid...
Well, maybe I can make one suggestion, because we could... I think handle a few of Mr. Gruskin's objections as a group, which is the arguments that we don't have jurisdiction over this because of some flaw in what it's seeking to do. I guess what I'm saying is, if this is a debate about how the title should be written, I'm maybe persuaded by what Mr. Gruskin said that maybe we could rewrite the title a little bit better. But if we're debating whether we should be throwing this out as we don't have jurisdiction, then there's a step missing in all the cases that I saw cited to us in the motion, which is saying that the title board is the place to decide whether these are appropriate types of measures or not. And if we all agree that whatever the merits of Mr. Gruskin's arguments there, that they're not properly addressed to us, then maybe we can move on without getting into the weeds any more than we already have.
And actually, I think that's helpful. I agree with that. I mean, I think there's various issues that are raised that might be raised if the measure passes, but I'm not sure that these are jurisdictional issues, that some of them are jurisdictional issues for the title board. The single subject one, I think, is. But the others, you know, whether this violates the supremacy clause, for example, I don't think that's something for the title board to decide. Realistically, probably not even whether something is legislative in character, perhaps. That's something that I think probably would have to be argued later if the measure passes. So I think that may be helpful to look at some of these as a group, because if we think those arguments don't relate to our jurisdiction, then probably we would not act on those. I think Mr. Domenico is correct. There's still issues of whether the title is as good a job as we can do, and whether there's a violation of single subject.
Right. I think numbers 2, 3, and 4 of the motion for rehearing are what I had in mind as interesting arguments that I'm not prepared, I don't think, to address here. that I just don't, I'm not aware of what obligation or authorization we have to make those sorts of decisions.
Well, just for the record, your comment is absolutely accurate, Mr. Domenico, that these are not issues in which the Supreme Court has spoken yet. But I do think that, particularly in the administrative context, the Supreme Court has said that certain issues need not proceed to the ballot if they are, in fact, administrative in nature. Whether there would be an action for a declaratory judgment after someone went to the expense of getting something on the ballot or not, I don't know. But I do believe that the board has this capacity. I understand that you probably don't agree, and I guess we'll find out.
Right, and I agree with that, that I'm not sure you necessarily need to wait until it's on the ballot for all these sorts of things. But I, just in the absence of either some clear direction from a court or some clarification in our authorizing statute that we are supposed to make that decision, I'm just uncomfortable doing it.
I think there's a consensus here on that. So, but the focus being on then single subject, that leaves the focus on single subject in the title, I think. While we still have Mr. Gruskin in front of us, before we turn to Mr. Caldera, I just want to find out if there's other questions or discussion that the board wants to pursue. I guess I'll jump into something here at the sake of either trying to understand this a little better or get some further discussion. I think it's a difficult issue about the weight of the phrase healthcare choice. I understand that that carries with it a lot, and I can understand that that might have there may be strong motivations, political motivations in choosing phrasing that might enlist support better than other phrasing. But on the other side of it is proponents, seems like they picked their words because this is how they interpret issues, and they're framing the issues the way they see them. And it seems to me that proponents may just see their measure as an issue of healthcare choice, just as some proponents may see their measure about tax cuts or term limits. We've had similar debates. I probably could come up with better examples where there's phrases that have maybe strong political support, but that's how proponents see their issues. And in this case, the operative words are, all persons shall have the right to healthcare choice. I mean, that is a right granted, if this measure were adopted, a right to be granted in the Bill of Rights. And understandably, it may not be perfectly clear what that means. Again, it might be like due process, the right to due process. I don't know exactly what it means, but can proponents propose that an addition to the Bill of Rights that would grant the right to healthcare choice? I'm reluctant to say they can't, because that phrasing is either very broad or it carries political weight. I think it has meaning. I think the measure goes on to prohibit certain things that, A, require people to participate in plans, which is about choice, or B, deny people the ability to make or receive payments for services, which is about choice. So it seems like the measure is about healthcare choice. Now, the fact that it doesn't expressly deal with other kinds of healthcare choices is, again, something it seems to me the proponents can choose to do in their measure. They're not required to deal with every kind of healthcare choice. So, you know, on the one hand, I appreciate the arguments about the political weight of the phrase healthcare choice, but it seems like that's what the measure fully intends, to grant that right of healthcare choice. As broad as that may be, I don't think it's as broad as water or some other things, but I think that's what the measure is about. And I wouldn't know how to set a title Otherwise, if we did not say what the measure does, it grants the right to health care choice. So, like I say, I'm not yet persuaded that there's a single subject violation or that there's a catchphrase problem.
Let me ask you this question. Let's say that there was a measure that had, well, as you know, the Supreme Court says just because it's in the measure doesn't mean you have to put it in the title. Yeah. So that's the starting point. The fact that the seed was planted, for whatever reason, maybe there was a political design, perhaps not, doesn't really make any difference. What the Supreme Court requires is that there be evidence that there is a political slogan that is reflected by the language that you set. And that was the whole reason we went through this exercise, in the event that it actually makes it up to the Supreme Court on this issue. But let me ask you what you would do, and this is a rhetorical question, obviously, but what if you had a case, an initiative that was comprised solely of something that the Supreme Court had already adjudicated to be a catchphrase. Like in the English, I think there was an English-only or immersion measure where there was some phrase in there about phasing out bilingual education as expeditiously and efficiently as possible, something like that. Well, what if that was the nub of the measure and you knew it was a catchphrase? Would you set a title that incorporates the catchphrase because that's what it does? And that's effectively the set of handcuffs that the proponents have put you in. I would suggest to you that the Supreme Court has released you from those handcuffs. You are not bound to use the language that they use. That language will be in the Blue Book. That language, we know, will be on TV. They are free to use it however they see fit. You are free to use whatever language accurately and in a non-prejudicial way describes this measure. And if you know something was a phrase is used solely for political reasons, it seems to me you cannot include it in the title. That you would allow the title to describe the two forms of legal change that will occur under this measure is absolute. And I absolutely talk about those two elements. But you don't have to color it by using the right of all persons to health care choice. And I think that the proponents are in front of you all the time and they've got little political nuggets buried for their own reasons. But that's not a constraint on your authority to use fair language.
But I think you raise a good question, and I do think that that English education measure is very troubling here, because I think, from my view, that measure, the heart of the measure was that language that required English language instruction to be as effective and efficient as possible or something. But there was a lot more to that measure, and the title board was nevertheless able to rewrite the titles and still talk about the different features of the measure. Following up on your rhetorical question, I mean, what if this measure only had the first sentence, all persons shall have the right to health care choice? What if that's all it said? And I think you would say we can't set a title. I would say we couldn't set a title because we can't use that phrase and we can't otherwise interpret it. So effectively, no proponent could propose a measure for the Bill of Rights that grants the right of health care choice.
I'm not sure if I agree. I'm not sure that I disagree. But it seems to me that one of the issues that, one of the procedures that inevitably is used is you hear out the proponents. What do you intend by this? I mean, I think it's the first question that you ask when you're trying to set a single subject. What are you trying to do here? And it seems to me that unless the proponents, you know, were mum on the question of what their intent was, you would have an idea of what the measure was intended to do. Obviously, that would, any title you set would have to be a function of the language they use. But yes, if you know that language is inherently prejudicial, intended or not, but nonetheless is inherently prejudicial as to the process, then it seems to me that, you know, you can certainly recommend to the proponents that they rewrite. But you don't have authority under the statute to set a title that you know is prejudicial. You are prohibited. You can only set titles that are fair and not misleading. And so, if you are presented with language you know to be unfair and misleading, how in the world can you act under the statute? And frankly, that's not your problem. The proponents, seems to me, have the choices available to them to include or not include these little language hand grenades. And once they choose to include one, whatever the consequence is. I, you know, frankly, you know I'm a big advocate of the process, but I don't really see that you have to cure the political designs of the proponents.
And I think I'm generally in agreement with Mr. Gruskin. I think we should hear from Mr. Caldera, but I think the difference between a situation like this and if the measure simply if a measure is itself nothing but a catchphrase, is that in that case, it's not the problem with catchphrases is that they are misleading, according to the Supreme Court, that they can cause people to vote for or against something
without understanding
really the rest of the measure, that it throws people off. If the measure is nothing but a catchphrase, I think that problem generally would disappear, because it would be almost by definition not misleading if all you're doing is voting for a catchphrase to stick it in the Constitution, which is not unprecedented efforts to do that. So I'm not sure I am as troubled as Mr. Gruskin, but I am troubled a little bit by the statement of the single subject that we have in the title. And I'm not sure we can't do better.
Mr. Carton.
Just one question. And I want to go back to Mr. Hobbs's comments. The first, the Section 32 is entitled Right to Health Care Choice, and the first sentence of subsection 1 says all persons shall have the right to health care choice. And I'm in agreement that the language that follows that particular sentence in subsection 1 in A and B relates to the right to health care choice. So what does a title board do if the language of the arguable catchphrase is embodied in the measure, and assuming that there's a connection between that phrase and the content of the measure, and we know that the phrase will be used in the political environment, or we're assuming that, does the case law say that, what does the title board do then? Is it forbidden? Is it, in your argument is that notwithstanding the fact that the language is embodied in the measure, and that there's a strong argument, and I know that you're not saying this, but that there's, it seems as though it expresses a single subject, that it nonetheless can't be used because potentially it could be construed as a catchphrase.
Well, I'd argue with your use of the word potentially. It seems to me that the author of this phrase says that it's all about trying to gain political leverage. I would tell you, it seems to me that if the issue of whether or not individuals have to accept an insurance mandate and can continue to pay their health care providers can be accurately described by reference to those elements, what does the right to health care choice add? If the right goes no farther than that, then that is simply an encapsulation, a political encapsulation, of the two elements that Mr. Caldera spoke of when this thing was first announced, and that we all have acknowledged are the two central elements of this measure. And so what does the political catchphrase, my words here, what does that add to communicating the issue about a mandate and the right to private payment of health care? Nothing. It's just an add-on, but it's a big political add-on. And therefore, it skews the debate. And it suggests that just talking about payment systems for health care is not sufficient to sell the idea, because only those ideas, those two ideas, are at the heart of this measure. with the exception for emergency medical care. So if maybe Mr. Caldera can enlighten us as to what the phrase means and how it adds to those two aspects. But short of that, it seems to me that by definition, you recognize that it is political surplusage, and therefore it's unnecessary.
Medical.
Can I just make a quick suggestion that I think partly responds to Mr. Cardin's question? In my view, our analysis of this issue has to go first. We have to decide whether we think it is, in fact, a catchphrase. If it's not, then this problem largely goes away, I think. If it is a catchphrase, then we have to decide what does that mean for us. My view is, I think what the court has told us is, if there's a catchphrase, we have to, if possible, not use the catchphrase in the title. So I think first we have to decide, is this a prohibited catchphrase? And if it is, we have to think about, can we write this title without it? But I'm not, before we get there, I want to make sure we've dealt with the number one of the motion for rehearing, which is whether, in fact, this has a single subject, because we're getting into how to write the title, and I'm not sure we got past the first part of the motion, which is whether this is a single subject or not.
Well, I'm speaking for myself. I'm not persuaded that it's that it violates the single subject requirement. But
just to agree with you on that, the only one that partly troubles me is the what's in the motion as 1F, which is the allegation that this expands somehow what are lawful healthcare services. I think we discussed that either last time or the first time this came up. I think that's overreads the measure. So I'm not sure I have to deal with that, with whether that would be a separate subject if it were, whether this tries to basically make legal things that are illegal under federal law or in some other state. I don't think that's the way the measure has to be read. I think the proponents told us that's not the intention. So given that, I don't think we have to address whether, if in fact it did do that, it would be a single subject violation.
Could I just opt in for just one clarification? The proponents added the word Colorado before law, which addressed the issue that was raised last time that I think you're referring to. But I'm still believe that it has the concern that we've discussed. But I just want to make sure that was part of your discussion, so you knew. Thank you.
So it sounds like there's consensus on the single subject as well, which still leaves us with the title. So I'm trying to simplify what Mr. Caldera needs to respond to. He's been chomping at the bit, but I think now we should hear from proponents, and I think there are some questions. Mr. Domenico.
Well, can we move now that can we make a motion that we have jurisdiction and then move on to, are all our questions now about the title?
I think so, although that we could do motions. You know, one way I'd anticipate it maybe is just simply if we, once we're ready to vote, there could be a motion that the motion for rehearing be denied except to the extent that the board amended the titles. If there's nothing but the title left that the board might want to adopt, it would be to deny the motion for rehearing except to the extent that the board amended titles.
Okay, well, I was going to suggest something like that just as a way to limit what Mr. Caldera feels he has to respond to, which would be numbers.
You don't have to limit me.
I think we do. Numbers 1 through 4 of the motion, I think, all go to our jurisdiction, and all of us, I think, we're comfortable denying them. Should I make a motion or just suggest that we turn to...
Well, one thing that occurs to me is that since we're not the final word on this, it may be that Mr. Caldera actually would like an opportunity to argue those points.
Why don't you go ahead? If that's how you're going to rule, then I will just my comments to Section 5 of this.
Okay. Well, and if that's the preference, Mr. Domenico, if you want to go ahead and offer...
No, that's fine. It doesn't matter to me when we do it, just as long as he doesn't spend a lot of time arguing things that we agree with him on.
Yeah. So, Mr. Caldera, you're comfortable limit... You're planning
yeah.
to...
I understand what you're trying to do, and I'm trying to be respectful of time, by the way. I was raised Catholic, and school, the nuns told me that if you're not really good, you go to purgatory for some time, and purgatory is when you're sentenced to serve on the title board. So I understand very well what you're doing. First of all, let me say, this is not a court. You are not judges. Your duty, and tell me if I'm wrong, is actually very, very specific. You have two things to do. One, decide if this meets a single subject. And it certainly does, as many other things have come through here. I could name them ad nauseum that are single subjects. Everything from campaign finance reform to ethics and government and all the rest are single subject, although they have many aspects. Let me also say that Mark's talking about a rehearing. Well, no. You weren't here for the hearing, Mark. These were objections that could have been brought up at the actual hearing where you set title for this. And all these things could have been done at that point. So I've got to wonder, a motion for rehearing, whether it's appropriate to be adding new evidence and new arguments that have not been held during the hearing. There was nobody here to make these claims. So that's why the board put this way. And I imagine that's part of the legal strategy to tie this up. When you heard this, there was no opposition. There was nobody saying, no, you shouldn't be using these terms when writing this proposal. Instead, Mark decided to hang back, let you write what you wanted to, and then put together this counter. So he was not involved in the process, which is too bad, because that's exactly what it's here for. So I'm wondering if it's kosher that new legal arguments are brought into evidence. I think that's very odd. And regrettable. But let me bring you back to this subject before. Let's remember that a couple of years ago, I brought a very similar measure here that did the same thing, the right to health care choice, and I believe that's how you put it into the language, and you certainly gave it a single subject. But let's go back to some of these things, particularly when it comes to the right to health care choice. I wrote this initiative. And this initiative was about a right to health care choice. That's why it wasn't the title of this. We have 32 sections in our Bill of Rights here in Colorado. It's from right to due process, to right to keep arms, to right to assembly, to right to expression. And this initiative adds one more, which is the right to health care choice. I cannot tell you how future courts will interpret that right to health care choice, just as I could not, I'm sure the founders of the state could not say what a right to free speech or a right to religious choice would be defined by courts in later generations. But it was clear that was the intent. Let me be very certain. This is the intent of this initiative, to make it a right in Colorado under our Bill of Rights that individuals have a right to health care choice. If that is not plainly expressed in the title of this, you are not at all writing what is in plain words. Let me go back a couple of years. I remember when campaign finance reform was a large issue. Matter of fact, it was a large issue when it was going through the federal government with McCain-Feingold, and it was called campaign finance reform. This was an argument that was being bantied around in the terms campaign finance reform. This title board, when bringing forward Amendment 27 that year, called it, "Shall there be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning campaign finance?" And in connection where therein, you did that. In the same way, we've done things such as ethics in government. We have done things such as the ERA. How do you say equal rights amendment without saying equal rights amendment? So just because these terminologies are being used in the political sphere doesn't mean it doesn't accurately describe what this measure does. And of course, people are talking about it in political circumstances. I want to thank Mark for doing such great research for me, because other than my press conference and what Linda who works with me at Independence Institute, wrote, "I haven't seen any of this research or commentary. This is the first time I've seen this." I'm not surprised that they're using the same terminology that I use, because that is the terminology of this initiative, to have health care choice. So when it comes to, and we can get into the bits and pieces, but I want to focus in on subsection D here. The right of all persons to have health care choice is a prohibited catchphrase. Well, then the right to due process is a prohibited catchphrase, and the right to keep and bear arms is a prohibited catchphrase, and we can go through so many other things in the Colorado Constitution, the federal constitution, that are in fact catchphrases. Let me make it very clear. This is about a right to our health care choices. And in connection therewith, because I know you like that, we have taken two aspects of that and clarified. That doesn't mean there are no other rights to health care choice. It means those other rights will be left for interpretation by the courts, but that it is a basic right here in Colorado to do so. I'm not asking you to vote for this. And we've got some, you know, you can say whatever you like, but just because these terms are being used inside the politics right now doesn't mean it doesn't accurately reflect what it does. Good God, it's right there. It's not the title of the bill. The first enabling piece of this, the very first primary phrase, is that this is that all persons have a right to health care choice. We further define what that means in a couple sections, but that is the key of it. And for that not to be included in a title would misrepresent this completely. And whether high-paid guys like Frank Luntz uses those terms or not, it's inconsequential. This is not a court of law. This is not a court of public opinion. Your job here is to give this an accurate title, and I recommend and request that you do so. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Caldera?
Go ahead.
So I think you answered an important question for me, but I just want to beat a dead horse maybe. The measure can be divided into two parts in my mind. The first part is the first sentence. All persons should have the right to health care choice. And the second part is everything that follows. And I think I hear you saying is that that first sentence, the second part is part of the first sentence, but the first sentence carries with it more than what follows, that there really is, your intention as a proponent is to grant in the Bill of Rights a right to health care choice, whatever that may mean, and what follows are two applications, examples, or whatever, but there's more to the measure than what is in the second part.
Absolutely. I can't imagine that not being clear by the words that we used here.
Okay.
Might be a right to expression, a right to free speech, a right to religious choice. I don't have the state constitution with me, but you go over many of those rights in the Bill of Rights, and if you were to, those don't mean that it's cut and dry. We don't know how the courts will interpret, limit, express that, but those are in the Bill of Rights, and this is another one.
So there may be things that aren't specifically mentioned. There may be applications that aren't specifically mentioned. Like Mr. Gruskin, I think, raised the issue of choosing your doctor, for example. So that would be arguably granted by this measure. It's not specifically talked about, but if the courts were to find that the right to health care choice includes the right to choose your doctor, then that's would become a state constitutional right.
Yes.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Sorry. What about abortion? Is this going to guarantee people a right to abortion or anything else?
That is why we put in a section here when it comes to lawful health care services are not any service or treatment permitted or not prohibited by any provision of state law. We want to make this very clear. This doesn't change
okay. What
our legal medical practices.
So the only limitations on the legislature's authority are the ones specifically laid out in A and B?
Specifically, yes. These are very specific.
Right. But so the legislature could pass something that says you don't have the right to choose your own doctor.
And that would be up to a court to interpret.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out. I mean, it's true that there are much broader things in the Constitution, free speech, due process,
and
right to bear arms, but they don't then come along with a short list of things that are specifically included and then also don't include this language about that this doesn't cover anything not prohibited by law.
That helps clarify, I believe, the first sentence of this.
Mr. Cardin?
One question, Mr. Caldera, Mr. Gruskin's motion 5B, the assertion that the title is inaccurate as the measure does not prohibit, etc., and focusing on the language of the measure, subsection 1 of section 32, beginning no statute, regulation, resolution, etc., and the current language in the title, after any connection therewith, prohibiting the state independently or at the instance of the United States. I guess my question is just generally, what's your response to that assertion that the current language of the title, the phrase right after in connection therewith, prohibiting the state, that phrase, that's inaccurate because the language of the measure doesn't prohibit, at least that's the assertion.
I think the way that the board wrote the title, and again, Mark was not here to add any of his comments at that time, and I believe that's by choice, and that's too bad because it would have been an interesting discussion. But right now you make it clear that this prohibits the state from adopting or enforcing these statutes. That is, I think, a fair reflection of this amendment.
So the language that says no statute, regulation, resolution, or policy adopted or enforced by the state of Colorado shall, that language prohibits the state of Colorado from adopting a statute, regulation, resolution, or policy.
The risk of getting into a law student debate over whether the state can pass something, the courts can just say you can't enforce it. I don't see any reason to go down that road here. It's interesting.
I just wanted to see what your response was to that.
But quite simply, it is, in this it says that no statute will do this. I think that prohibits the state from adopting or enforcing those policies, both. It's pretty clear. No statute shall. I don't know how that can be any more clear that is a prohibition. No statute shall do this. Now, as far as the legal maneuvering, if the court says, all right, well, it stays on the books, it's just not enforced, or if they yank it off the books completely, that's for the courts to decide, I guess, how they handle it. But yeah, it is a prohibition. I don't know how else you could read no statute shall require any person directly or indirectly to participate in any public or private health insurance plan. Well, that's pretty clear. No statute, no regulation, no resolution, no policy shall do that. That is a prohibition.
Thank you.
Here.
Further questions for Mr. Caldera? Mr. Gruskin, any final word?
No. I'll ask you to, let me first deal with a technical issue. The law is very clear that a motion for rehearing can be filed. It doesn't have to be filed by someone who was present or someone who made a presentation earlier. In fact, my presence on number 40, Mr. Caldera's first initiative, I think is a matter of record. The fact that I wasn't able to attend
doesn't mean that there's any constraint on the ability to file a motion for rehearing. So I take what was a technical procedural motion and suggest to you that it is not relevant to your considerations here. Likewise, the reference to Mr. Caldera's initiative from a couple years ago is irrelevant. Why? Because what the Supreme Court has said is that based upon evidence in the context of current or contemporary political debate, you have to decide whether or not something's a catchphrase. What happened in the past, if that wasn't a hot-button issue, is irrelevant if you know that it is today. Third, while I don't, and I tried to go to some length to say that political motives weren't a part of your analysis, Mr. Caldera maintains that he'd never seen or heard of the Luntz memo or any of the controversy around that. Let me hand you what I'd like the record to reflect is exhibit number 11. Patient Power is a project of the Independence Institute. It has a website, and the web address for the document I just handed you is indicated at the bottom of page 2. Patient Power is a project that is staffed by people at the Independence Institute. Mr. Brian Schwartz wrote an article about 2 weeks after the Luntz memo became public about what he liked in the Luntz memo. Now, who is Mr. Schwartz? Well, remember that Aurora Sentinel article that talked about healthcare choice? He and Ms. Gorman co-authored it. So is it possible that this whole issue, even though it was in a major public forum, was never on the radar screen of Mr. Caldera? I suppose, but it was on his website and articles by his staffers were written about it. So if there is some sort of judicial determination that the proponents had to have knowledge, it seems to me that here they had at least constructive knowledge. The issue I guess I want to close with is this. Mr. Caldera has been through a review and comment hearing, and now three title board hearings. So he's been through four hearings. He also made a very public statement about what his measure was about. And today, for the first time, you hear that the right to healthcare choice really isn't about Obamacare or insurance mandates. It's about a bigger, broader piece. I would suggest to you that that is a commentary of the moment. It's not what Mr. Caldera has said about his measure from day one. From day one, it's been about maintaining choice. He told you at both the hearing on number 40 and the first one on number 45 that it was about maintaining healthcare choice and creating options in terms of that choice for payment. For him to now say the measure is really bigger and broader means you set a title on March 17th without knowing what the measure was really about. And likewise, I suggest to you that no one really knows what this is about. If either Mr. Caldera's rationalization is of the moment, or if it's accurate, then he didn't tell you when you set the ballot title what it was about. And I would suggest to you, that, and I believe it was your comment, Mr. Hobbs, that if it's that broad a statement, you really don't know what this measure entails. And the Supreme Court has been very clear. You can't set a title if you don't know what the measure entails. You denied the single subject motion on our part because you knew what it addressed. You knew that it addressed the issue of choice among payment options. If that's not right, then I move at this point that you revisit the determination on single subject and that you know, at least from the proponents, what that single subject is, and that failure to revisit it at this point, when the statements have been that a right to healthcare choice is so broad-ranging that you couldn't possibly know its ramifications, is indicative that, frankly, this is not a single subject. One way or the other, healthcare choice is either a damning political phrase that cannot be included, or it's such a broad, inherent phrase that the measure really is limitless. and it is communicated inappropriately by the title. I would also suggest to you that all the other rights, Mr. Domenico, I think, had a very accurate analysis. None of the other rights are imposed as this one is. None of the other ballot titles that you've had before you, notwithstanding races, campaign finance, term limits, ethics and government, have been shown to you to be used for specific purposes in political ways. And therefore, none of them are binding upon you. And the fact that you know that it deals with abortion now, and the Supreme Court has said, particularly as to abortion, when you are affecting abortion rights, if you're changing a standard at all, you have to be clear in the title. You have to be clear about that in the title. And not just the least of which, because there's been an admission on the record here, the word choice is heavily laden in contemporary political debate. And if choice applies in the way that Mr. Caldera says it does, you have to reflect that in the title. So I would renew my single subject motion. I apologize for putting you through that, but I have to do that for the record. Because you now know that the subject of this measure is not what you were told, and that it is much more broad-ranging, and that the title is therefore not what it was intended to be. Thank you very much.
Mr. Caldera, I'll give you briefly.
Oh, absolutely. Let me respond to these because it's very important. First of all, when Mark says that 2 years ago that you might have used the term right to health care choice, but you can't do it this time because other people now are using it in the political lexicon, your job is not to decide what ballot measures are described on depending on the whims of what's going on politically. Your job is to describe this accurately. And if you described it accurately 2 years ago, how possibly could it be inaccurate this year because Frank Luntz writes a memo on that? On the issue of the website, by the way, the Independence Institute runs at least a half a dozen to a dozen different blogs from different writers. I'm thrilled that the guy keeping an eye on Patient Power was wise enough to keep that. I don't read our blogs regularly, but good for him. Glad he was on top of that. That doesn't mean I knew it. I could list all nearly dozen different blogs and web pages that we host and different people who are in charge of that, but that doesn't matter. And by the way, the statements on those blogs and even the statements that I make are not as important as what is down on a piece of paper. What is down on this paper is, I believe, self-explanatory. Let me make it very clear, for the record, I'm not saying that this deals with abortion. This does not deal with abortion. Any other thing to say would be a mischaracterization of my terms. I want to make that very clear so that nobody runs with that and says ridiculous things. That's why we clarified this with Colorado law, that this right to health care choice does not include any medical procedure that is not currently legal by law, Colorado law. We specified Colorado law. We make it really clear about that. That's what this law says, that's what this law means, that's what this does. It does not open up any other scare tactic. So the risk of saying, of politicizing this process, I cannot allow that. That being said, I ask you to deny a motion for rehearing. I think the idea that none of these people who were objecting to this could have made it back 2 weeks ago to put in any of these complaints makes me very suspect that this is genuine. Be happy to. They needed to be here during that hearing. We were. Thank you.
So then I'll turn it over for board discussion and decision. Barton.
I guess what I would say first is that kind of in response to Mr. Hobbs's line of questioning on what exactly was meant by the phrase "all persons shall have the right to health care choice," and I think Mr. Gruskin has made has made some strong points in kind of re-raising the single subject issue when I think the board had rejected that. But I'm not persuaded that, based on Mr. Gruskin's arguments, that necessarily changes in my mind that the measure as written contains a single subject. And I'll stop there.
I guess I feel similarly. I do think the phrase is a very persuasive phrase for a lot of people, and it may, you know, it may be proponents, maybe there's strategy behind it, but I think that's perhaps the way the proponents look at what their measure does. In any event, the measure, apart from intentions or motivations or whatever, the measure explicitly grants the right to healthcare choice. That's the first sentence. And I think words have meaning. And I think if there's a defect in the title, arguably it's because the title doesn't say that the measure grants the right to healthcare choice. It just says the subject is healthcare choice. When I review my notes about catchphrases, I think it may be a relatively close issue, but I'm still on the side of believing that this is not a catchphrase. The particular case that was most troublesome was 1999-2000 number 258A, which was English language education in public schools, and that's the case that was about the measure that the title included a phrase requiring all children in Colorado public schools to be taught English as rapidly and effectively as possible. And that was language right out of the measure, and the court held that was an impermissible catchphrase. The court went on to say that catchphrases are words that work to a proposal's favor without contributing to voter understanding. It seems to me that whether or not this works to the measure's favor, this is what the measure grants. It's a constitutional right to health care choice. I don't know necessarily what all the effects or applications of that constitutional right would be, but it seems to me that's what the measure does, and I wouldn't know how to phrase it any other way than what the measure says. Mr. Gruskin's correct that if we don't understand a measure, we're prohibited from setting a title. But I think that line of cases is where the measure is so complex or the wording is so difficult that we don't know what a measure does. I don't think it's to the contrary. I think there's also cases that say just because we don't know all of the effects or applications of a measure, that doesn't mean that we can't conclude that it's a single subject. And I think there is a single subject, and it seems to me that the titles there may be some refinement, but basically the title I think is accurate, and I would not be persuaded at this point that the phrase healthcare choice is a prohibited catchphrase. Domenico?
I agree that it's a single subject. I think Mr. Gruskin's reply to Mr. Caldera's answers to our questions overstated what he told us, what Mr. Caldera told us about the effect of this. So I'm still in a position that this is, I don't have a problem with this on single subject purposes. I'm still troubled about whether the right of all persons to healthcare choice is a catchphrase. I appreciate Mr. Caldera's arguments. I don't think I disagree with much of what he said about that this is, in fact, the way this issue is discussed, not as a catchphrase, but as a way to inform people what you're talking about. On the other hand, I think Mr. Gruskin is right that the court has said that fact alone doesn't save something from being a catchphrase. And if I were a proponent of this measure, I would be very nervous about whether I could win that argument in the Supreme Court, and would suggest we might be doing Mr. Caldera a favor by revising the statement of the single subject. But maybe it makes sense first to make a motion on our jurisdiction now and move on to discussion of the title, since it sounds like we're all in agreement on the single subject at least, so we don't all just discuss everything. Or
one thing we could do, I guess, is a motion that would deny the motion for rehearing with respect to 1 through 4.
But I was going to propose to move. So I'll make that motion right now.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. So then with respect to the title, Mr. Domenico?
Well, as I talked about with a number of measures lately, I think we tie ourselves in knots a little bit by trying to get too detailed in our statement of the single subject, and essentially try to capture everything important about the measure, not only in the title, but in the statement of the single subject. And I know that part of that is from court precedents that have knocked us around in all directions. But I would start leaning towards, when we're struggling, writing a really broad statement of the subject, even if it's broader than what really is being done, or what we would describe as the single subject in a discussion, and recognize that the statement of the subject really should be understood as intended just to give people an idea of what, which of the many initiatives they might be about to read about. So in this one, I would suggest we'd be fine saying an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning healthcare. And then we get into what it has to do with healthcare later. Now, I know if you tried to go into court and say the single subject of this is just healthcare, then you really would be running into the water and other judiciary difficulties. But I'm not sure that necessarily the statement in the title of the single subject has to be so narrow as to fit within all those precedents, because I think it's just too hard and it doesn't help the voter, in my view. So that's where I would lean towards heading on that. I think that solves the catchphrase issue. I think it's accurate. I think that the rest of the title makes clear that this isn't trying to do with all sorts of disparate issues within healthcare. It's just a simple statement meant to give voters an idea of what is going to come. And then the rest of the language tells them, well, what are you doing about that subject, healthcare? And here's the couple of things that this affects when it comes to healthcare. On the other hand, if we wanted to get more detailed, I have some thoughts about that too. But if everyone else is comfortable that the right of all persons to healthcare choice is not a catchphrase, then I guess we don't need to get into any of that. So maybe that's where we should start, is whether or not that's a catchphrase. I'm nervous that whether any of us think it is, it will be held to be one by the Supreme Court.
Well, I think that could go either way. I think there's reasons to be nervous about whether or not it's a catchphrase. I don't think at this point that it is. If I knew of a way to duck that issue, I would like to do that. My concern about this particular case, my concern about broadening the subject to avoid the catchphrase problem, is then that would leave us with a title that makes no reference to healthcare choice. And in other words, the first sentence of the measure would not appear in the title. There would be nothing in the title about the first sentence. And I think that may be the central provision, is the constitutional right to healthcare choice. So that if there were a way to avoid the potential catchphrase issue, that would be good, but I don't see how we can leave out something about the first sentence.
I actually don't view that as a central feature of the measure. I view it a bit more like the introduction to the Second Amendment, that is sort of just an explanation of setting the stage of the action of the measure, which in the Second Amendment is the right to keep and bear arms. Here, it's the right, here it's the prohibition on enforcing or adopting statutes that either force you to buy health insurance or prevent you from buying, from purchasing or selling your own health care services. That's what this does. It also says everyone has the right to health care choice. I think in our colloquy with Mr. Caldera, it became fairly clear that this isn't meant to do much other than those two things. And so to me, it's a statement, it's an important statement to the proponents. It doesn't do anything, I don't think. And if it does a lot, then Mr. Gruskin may be right that we have a problem with single subject or with our jurisdiction.
And it may be that it doesn't do much, but I think it does something, and I think it's for the courts to decide whether it's much, whether it's a little bit or a lot. But I think I hear the proponents saying it does something more than what the rest of the measure provides, and I'm just concerned if we don't apprise the voter of that there's more to it than just what's talked about in the rest of the title, then if the courts end up finding other applications of that first sentence, then we would have omitted that from the title. So I feel like whether it's a little bit or a lot, it's something that is potentially significant, and there needs to be something in there. But it's because I wasn't convinced that there was a lot to it that I was willing to not include an explicit statement that it grants, that the measure grants a constitutional right of health care choice. Mr. Carden?
And I would agree with that. I think, first of all, I do, first, as far as the catchphrase, the record that's been established here, I'm very appreciative to Mr. Gruskin for the information he provided in connection with the assertion that the language of the title currently is misleading or is a catchphrase. I don't think it's a prohibited catchphrase. And again, I base that on some of the preceding case law that has addressed that issue. I think it is a central feature of the measure. It's embodied in the measure. It will be used in the campaign without question. But I also want to give credence to Mr. Caldera's argument that simply because the phrase is used in a political environment does not automatically make it an impermissible slogan, especially when you're adding another right to the Bill of Rights that's entitled Right to Health Care Choice, that has a statement that all persons shall have a right to health care choice. And again, I would say an adequate record has been established that it's foreseeable that this issue will be visited by the Supreme Court. And I think that it has been adequately addressed at this phase. Currently, the measure says concerning the right of all persons to health care choice. And I note that the measure speaks to the right to health care choice. I don't know whether the addition of all persons necessarily is kind of substantive to whether or not that particular phrase should be changed, but I guess I'm inclined to agree with Mr. Hobbs, disagree with Mr. Gruskin, agree with Mr. Caldera, that as written, it expresses the single subject. And I also want to say that I think Mr. Domenico's point about how the board writes titles is a good one. and one worth considering. But at this point, I would suggest that we move forward with the language as it's written, subject to other possible revisions.
Are there other changes to the title that board members would like to consider?
I think there are a couple of the of Mr. Gruskin's that are worth discussing, listed in 5A, I think, and maybe 5B. I don't know if we didn't discuss 5A really at all. I thought that numbers 2, 3, and 4 at least were worth considering. Didn't seem to... I don't know if Mr. Caldera has a problem with any of those suggestions, but I didn't. I don't think I have a problem with any of them, and they seem not to hurt. I don't know if anyone else cares one way or the other about those. I wasn't convinced that number 1, 5A1, was worth adding.
I think probably for me personally, Roman numeral 4 was the one that I thought might have the most merit, but and possibly Roman numeral 3, but I really hadn't thought that one through.
My view is it's probably okay without making any of those changes, but that I didn't think it would hurt to make them either.
And I'd agree with that, Mr. Chair. And as again, I've noted that Mr. Caldera seems to be nodding that he doesn't have an issue with any of those changes, but I guess it would be...
I don't feel strongly about any of them. I think the title we set in those senses is accurate, not misleading. I just thought that those were at least worth considering. If nobody else wants to make them, I'm not going to move. So if nobody else wants to bother with them, I'm fine to move on to B, which did generate some discussion. Again, I think I'm comfortable with it the way it is. I think it's accurate. I think if we want to try to eliminate one potential area of dispute going forward, that could be rewritten, I think. So line 2, after in connection therewith, said something like, providing that the state shall not adopt or enforce any statute, etc., then it would more closely track the tense or mood of the actual language in the measure. I'm not quite sure of which grammatical term I'm after there. The one thing, my view is that the way the measure is written would cover past enactments of the legislature to the extent there are any, while the way it's written would suggest this is only about going forward, that prohibiting the state from enacting something is a prohibition on its taking some action, whereas saying the state shall, no statute shall do these things, would apply to existing statutes, I think, and so it might be better. I don't share Mr. Gruskin's view of what that means, but I do think it means something maybe slightly different than the way it's written in the measure.
I don't feel strongly about it one way or another. I think it struck me that the way the title's worded right now, which says it prohibits the state from enforcing any statute, I thought maybe that was sufficient to cover the previous enacted measures, but I don't.
And I think it is, which is why I say I think it's accurate the way it's written. But as Mr. Gruskin pointed out, it's written in a different. Mm-hmm. It is different, and if there's any question about it, it might be better to write it more closely tracking the actual language. I don't think it's misleading, because I share your view that whether it was written either way, it does the same thing, I think.
Right. I think this is what we're saying, is that as written, it reaches the same outcome, basically, that the language as written states. Because I guess, you know, to stay true to the language, just going down the road, and again, I'm not advocating for this particular change, but to stay true to the language of the measure, although it may not, again, the way that the language is currently stated, it is accurate, although it doesn't repeat the language of the measure verbatim. The alternative way to do it, it would seem, is to say that after "in connection therewith," you just jump to statute and say "in connection therewith," specifying that no statute, regulation, resolution, or policy adopted or enforced by the state independently or at the instance of the United States shall require a person. So in other words, instead of kind of Mr. Domenico's point, instead of the language that says prohibiting the state, you're more or less kind of repeating the idea that it specifies that if there is a statute or a regulation out there right now, but it could be, kind of going in circles here, but I guess that would be one way to do it from a drafting standpoint. Whether that improves it, whether that makes it more accurate, is dubious. So,
yeah, I don't think it's misleading as it is, and if nobody else does, then I think we should leave it.
Your motion. I'm not persuaded on that one personally, but
no, I think that the concept of healthcare choices could be broader than what's actually going on here. As I said, I don't think that C fits within what a typical voter would consider a healthcare choice, meaning the option to have the government create some program is not what I think your typical voter, but I guess I admit that may show my ideological bias, but there are things that I think are troublesome about healthcare choice, given the limitation, given what actually happens here. As I said before, I don't think those are problematic.
D, I think we've dealt with, or we've discussed. E, I...
Can I just say for the record on D, I think I agree with you that this should not be a prohibited catchphrase. It's really what it is shorthand, and as I read those memos, they say use these words instead of these other words, which doesn't, just because politicians or campaigners are told to use certain words as opposed to others, doesn't make everything that they would put in the "hey, use this language" a catchphrase. I mean, it's shorthand for a current debate, which I view as different, I think, than a prohibited catchphrase. I just am nervous that it's close, and it certainly is something that will be used politically in the court, especially in certain types of measures, has taken pretty seriously the catchphrase prohibition and read it fairly strictly, as Mr. Grushkin pointed out. And so that's my only concern. I think healthcare choice, everybody is correct, it does do that. It does state that. It is not inaccurate. It's not something that I think is misleading, and therefore it shouldn't be a catchphrase. So I think I'm in agreement. I was just suggesting we could be extra careful if we wanted to be.
Any motion with respect to paragraph E? The assertion that there's a new and controversial legal standard. I don't agree with that one, but if it's...
Right, I think we talked about that.
Well, then I think if we adopted a motion with respect to items 1 through 4 in the motion for rehearing, so I think it would be in order to have a motion with respect to item 5.
I move that the title board deny paragraph 5 of the motion for rehearing.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And that concludes action on the motion for rehearing. The time is 12:31 p.m., and we will reconvene at 1:30. Thank you.